Welcome to the seventh installment of the Polycast Side Series Evergreen. I'm Wouter, Recruiter Snijders. The series' seventh season consisted of 25 episodes and a special, was recurring and extensive coverage of the second Civilization V expansion pack released that year. As with the previous six Evergreens, Polycast regular co-host Daniel 10Q Quick selected and ranked the 10 topics he feels most retain their relevance years after they were first published. As well, recurring guest co-host Canis Albinus pre-listened to the entire season to select the 10 most representative moments for the show. Grab your four-leaf clovers and your rabbit's feet as we listen in to get lucky. But not like that. Number 10, from episode 165, how playing Civilization can not only complement one's life, but in fact improve it.
This game changed my life. That's true for me, okay, but this is also, someone else has said this, it's not just me, started by LPMC723, capital on the L. I was in the store one day and saw this game on the shelf, and yes, this game being Civilization V, at least I assume, seeing as I was in a Civ V forum. $50 being the price, I was a little unsettled to say the least. I decided against it and went home, but the game never left my mind, so I looked online at some videos and read some reviews, all of which made this game look amazing. So after a few days of debate, I figured this game was more than worth the price attached to it, so I went back to the store and picked it up. Now let me explain how this changed my life. After a few weeks of playing this game, I got so fascinated with ancient and past civilizations that I began to read up on them, and I studied a lot of world history and read as much as I could because I became so curious and fascinated with things. All of this led me to think about my life and what I was doing. I was 29 years old with a job that paid next to nothing, and I couldn't make ends meet on some months. So I decided that if I'm studying all of this on my own for no reason, why not do it for real? So I enrolled in college to make something of my life. I'm now a few months short away from having my associate's degree in business, and after which I will have a great, decent-paying job lined up that will see me set up to continue for my bachelor's degree. And I assure you, all of this is because the game sparked an interest in me to study history and got me thinking. And my favorite response in the thread was from Kamikaze, who was a guest on episode 83 of Polycast back in 2009, where he says, "It changed my life, too. I used to be a productive member of society." For a productive member of society.
We could all say that. It changed our lives. Look up Steam. 700 hours of Civ 5. Oh, God.
Just 700? Seriously?
I think I'm only 700. Hey, No. All my hours are in Team Fortress 2, you know.
Well, 700, you are a lightweight, sir. Lightweight.
You have not had your life changed. You may go back home.
Okay. Just because I don't have that many hours. Like I said, I may only have, if this thing will ever low, it's like 500, 600, 700. I've got 1,500 in TF2. There is my life.
Oh, so you've wasted 1,500 hours in TF2?
Yes, another 600 on top of that in Civ 5.
Hey, guys, look at it this way. At least there's no counter to tell us how much time we've wasted in Minecraft.
Yep.
no, Raptor tracks Minecraft for me.
Oh, dear.
Well, I would say we should give Chris some slack here. What about previous Civ titles? Give those at, you know,
discounted rate.
No, all my Civ 4 hours are tracked by Steam as well. I'm a late bloomer to Civ.
Yeah, see, if you take your TF2 and then you add it to your Civ, and then even if you add your Civ 4 time, that still doesn't add up to my official Civ 5 time. And that's just the official one. That had nothing to do with...
with the unofficial stuff, the side stuff.
Yeah, well, the gods and kings.
Oh, God.
No,
I don't think you're... I don't think life has been changed.
I'm a lightweight, like, horizontally, no, but still.
I only had 460 hours played, but then I played some offline, so...
Yeah, okay. I've got 1,250 in Civ 5. Civ has definitely changed my life. If you're wondering, Dan, how is that possible?
Look, you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
Welcome to this Polycast.
Mackie 2. But this helped me do. Well, let's see. I took over a Civilization fan site here that I looked after for almost 11 years. It got me to the point where I was the director for not one, but two gaming networks. I was able to write for a strategy magazine out of the United Kingdom for a year and a half. I was briefly on the writing staff for GameSpy. And there's this podcast, and then there was this convention I went to 6 years ago about Civ, and I got a chance to, you know, tour the Firaxis offices not once but twice. So this game has definitely had an impact on my life. You know, from the context of this thread, it changed LPMC723's life for the better. I think it hasn't improved my life for the better, but, you know, history will be the true judge of that, I suppose.
Yeah, I could say it's similar. I mean, if it wasn't for Civ 5, I probably would be streaming at some point. But I did start my YouTube and streaming based off Civ 5.
Number 9, from episode 188. Permitting works to gain experience and promotions, like military units, get some attention.
We have a thread here from Captain Patch on Civ Fanatics, who brings up the question, should we give experience and promotions to workers? He says, unlike the other small or civilian units like Great People, Missionaries, Inquisitors, etc., workers persist after their first use. They stay around the entire game, and they have specialization just like military units, but they don't get promotions like military units do. So he believes they should add a set of worker promotions to reflect their developing expertise. He suggests 3 promotions in a row, removing 1 turn for project duration on each one. Another set of 3 promotions, adding movement points for the first one for everywhere, the second for traveling on roads, and the third for when fleeing nearby enemy units. And the final one he suggests is stealth, so they don't get spotted by enemy units.
Hmm. Don't mind me building this giant fortress. Dun-de-dum-de-dum.
You know, stealth fortress.
There's something to be said about comparing this to military units, though, because with military units, the rate at which you get promotions varies a lot based on what you're actually doing in the game, whereas with workers, you're probably using them to make improvements as much as you can, and if you're microing well, there's not going to be a lot of variance there. So basically, that would just wind up being a global buff to workers. I don't know that we need that per se. So unless there's some way to make this a bit more dynamic, I don't see it in this form.
Yeah, well, then there's the, well, what do we do with the pyramids, which gives worker buffs. Liberty, which gives worker buffs. Movement point when traveling on roads and railroads, well, there's tech buffs for that, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's kind of, there already is experience for workers indirectly through those things, as opposed to directly from it as the workers do. So I guess it becomes a question of where do you want the experience to be reflected? And quite frankly, I prefer it as it is right now, because this is a non-military unit, like is pointed out. So yes, these units do stick around, unlike, say, workboats, or Great People, or Missionaries, or Inquisitors. I suppose I could be convinced otherwise, but, like, the specifics in terms of the promotions they get, like, minus 1 turn to project duration, wow. I know we can't stack workers, but still, I think that becomes a bit too much if you start doing the math over an extended period of time.
Well, there's the little issues like, oh, unit pillages a tile, you instant fix it, and it pillages the tile again.
Oh, that fun little thing. Combat workers. They're almost like combat medics.
I mean, they're not going to patch that out. I thought that was going to be patched out a while ago.
Well, it takes such a specific edge case for that to even work, like, sufficiently, that it's kind of, yeah. But if you give them experience and also give them these minus turns project duration, like minus 3 turns to project duration basically means you can build most basic tile improvements in 1 turn or instant. And if you have a unit that has no movement cost of pillaging, just pillage, 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 pillage. Don't mind me. I'm just going to massive goose. Granted, I would suggest that he was probably thinking that we would remove, say, the Liberty side and the pyramid stuff and whatever tech-based things, just to give them a benefit of the doubt, so that it's not stacked on top of that. And in that respect, Maybe.
Some incentive, some minimum that build your workers earlier than.
Yeah, and, you know, choose an experience tree. I'm not sure reductions to project durations should be there. One promotion could be, instead of being captured, it auto-moves to the next tile, because, you know, workers can be grabbed right off the mark. It's a no-cost thing.
It seems like, by his logic, we should be giving every unit on the field that's military a promotion just because one of them gets a promotion.
Or because they exist.
Yeah.
Build military units early and upgrade them, and you should have, like, hardcore veterans by the modern era, even if they just sat in your capital.
And besides, when a worker completes a train improvement or repairs something, it's really giving benefit in other forms, from food and production and science and movement and trade and win.
Yeah.
Potentially. So the individually, it's a bit more abstracted. The experience by workers is reflected otherwise in the game in those more general things, as well as more specific things like wonders and social policy trees.
But, I mean, if you want to go that way, you could do promotions like 33% less project duration for working in a jungle or something like that for specialties. So you can think of it that way rather than just a direct project duration reduction or other stuff. But yeah, realistically, workers are not meant to be that useful.
You're not supposed to be Uber.
Yeah, they already do, like, everything to make your empire bigger without actually using military units. So making them even better and therefore getting a better empire out of it faster kind of throws balance off, causes other issues.
Six half dozen of the other, but the way workers right now, I don't see that it's broken. So if something isn't broken, it doesn't need to be fixed.
Number 8 from episode 172. Making an eliminated save's return from and in the same game meaningful takes consideration.
Life. Glorious life. We have brought them back to life.
Hey.
Spread it before it spreads. Zwyzor. Zwyzor, maybe. Zwyzor. I want to talk about the recalling to life mechanic. He has an idea that, and Phil has to close his ears at some point. At some point, yes, he has to close his ears.
I know where this is going.
Yeah, so apparently reviving a conquered civ, you know, one that's been completely wiped out, is more of a fancy thing you do because you're bored than a good thing to mess with your rivals. So basically, bringing a civ back to life is there just for fun, as far as he's concerned. And other than a diplomacy victory, because they will vote for you, in general, they're kind of a waste of time to do that. Though, you can always hand them cities, you can always hand them units, and if you really want that recalled to life civ to be of value, you can just pump them up, and then there will be a value. So the problem is, what he had a problem with, of course, and where his suggestion comes in, he'd like to suggest either giving the recaller an option to boost the recalled, as in the one that got brought back, with known technologies, or automatically push freshly independent at similar level of technology to other civilizations. Self-balanced by lack of economy, take some time for new civ to catch up with the rest of the world, depends on difficulty level, or at least give them a temporary boost to military production, which never made sense to me. If we walked in and gave Lithuania back its independence, would they be able to produce new units? No, you'd have to build that. Stuff like that. Anyways, this suggestion is backed by written history. It does know many cases of countries gaining independence after many years, up from decades to millennia, but not a single case of sending mass-produced spikemen against tanks in the modern era. So basically his idea is give the liberated civ techs. And later on in the thread, it says, we should do tech trading because that would solve this problem.
I know, yeah, the tech trading, that was a Halley-Hal Cyan 2 that said that. That wasn't the
OP. Yeah, it wasn't the OP. But basically, my answer is no, it's not a good idea. One possible suggestion here is that if a civ has been conquered by another civ completely, and it has been conquered fully for a period of time, then when you recall that civ back to life, they should be at tech parity with the civ that conquered them. Not the one that recalled them to life, as in, if I walk over with a bunch of pikes and stab a GDR on the head, they shouldn't get pikes, they should get GRs. Basically. So if they've been conquered for a period of time, that's the tech that I would suggest would be the one that they should pick up.
I don't know. It's not plausible.
It's still a bad idea, but...
Well, at least the person doing the liberation, giving them technology, makes some degree of sense compared to the person that conquered them in the first place. The Sith that conquered them wasn't going to give them anything. They wanted them out of there.
Except that they're incorporating them into their empire. And then everywhere in the empire, if they're incorporated, as in, you know, it's been there for a while, would have access to the technology. You're not going to build a university in a conquered city unless you share the technology about building a university.
I guess.
That would make sense. It'd be kind of like the states wandering in and, I don't know, liberating some backwater country that's been conquered for a while.
Hmm.
They don't automatically get access to the U.S.'s technology.
I don't think the U.S. gave them the technology, though. That's why.
And that's the thing. They wouldn't give them the technology. But they do have the technology of the people who conquered them long ago because they've been living there. And
all right, that's fine. I don't think this will impact the majority of games regardless.
Yeah, no. Some people have already said, you know, just hand them new cities if you want them to get better.
Yeah, where would you do that? Especially if the map's already pretty crowded. Someone's getting wiped out fairly late and then brought back fairly late. And or.
Well, if you're a conqueror and you're liberating somebody, you can always hand them cities that you're conquering to offset your unhappiness problem.
That's true.
Which is what some people do. It's a nice storage location for cities, because you can always turn around and just kill the Civ anyways if you want the cities back. It's not like they were a problem in the first place.
You're a little unpopular, but you could do it.
Oh, well, you're going to be unpopular anyway.
That's true.
But the point is, I think it's all about being able to do a diplomatic thing. The extra vote for the UN, somebody else to help you, or a buffer. Or, you know, if you do hand a number of cities to the AI that's been recalled, you can sign research agreements with them. Because eventually they'll have a big enough empire to sign that, and you'll never have to worry about them again. The idea of transferring techs to a liberated civ, I can see you bringing up non-military techs. All the simple stuff that's just improvement-wise. I can see some of that, but it wouldn't be tech trading, or from the person doing the liberating giving the techs.
I don't like the idea of feeding techs in civ games anyway.
Yeah.
Like, the investment you do to tech is so large. In fact, I don't like research agreements, but I think they're better than tech trades because they're less overpowered compared to other aspects of researching, just pure research. But when you have, some mechanic where you can take all this hard work and instantly transfer it over to another civ, the potential for abuse or for getting completely and utterly screwed is just enormous. And it really does break the game to some extent. Like, the importance of strategy versus, oh, I got this guy to hand me a bunch of texts. Or, oh, I handed this guy a bunch of texts and now he wins for me. No, I don't like that setup. Remove something from the game that's otherwise there, which is the importance of your turn-to-turn choices.
I don't know, maybe for a short period of time, the revived Civ could have if they had enough and they were, you know, they were able to get it, you know, like a discounted research agreement, either in terms of gold cost or how much in terms of the science output that they would be able to get, assuming they got to the end of the research agreement. I could see that possibly, not from now until the end of the game, once they're liberated, of course, but just in the short term, as opposed to, outright gifting tax.
Screw it, just give them a 50-turn golden age.
Yeah.
All settled and done.
Done. I guess if that gets brought back, tends not to have a great city. So Golden Age, when you're making zero or less, isn't really going to help you much.
Yeah, 50-turn Golden Age, troll all. It's good.
0% of zero is.
Everything is settled.
I mean, some people are complaining, and it's like, oh, well, whenever possible, you know, when you liberate a civ, the wolves are going to come try and kill them. Well, okay, if you're going to take the effort to liberate a civ, you've taken personal responsibility for that civ's existence. For at least the period of time it takes to get them up and running. So don't complain if they get wiped out because you said he wandered over going, we liberated you. See ya.
You can liberate them again. It's all good.
Do you get extra bonuses for liberating them twice?
They'll vote for you twice as hard.
We love you twice as much.
I don't think it would matter a whole lot, though, because liberated civs along this line, they're really not competitive forces in the game ever again unless the human player goes out of his way to give them stuff that they are.
I'd be worried about higher difficulty levels because the AI gets pretty massive bonuses going there. So
yeah, but again, like, okay, is some super AI going to liberate a civ in the first place? And if it does, will the liberated civ be any significance at all?
Yeah, it depends on what they had. I mean, if they were a culture civ and they're now at One City, but it happens to have all the right stuff and they had their all the right social policies, maybe.
That would be pretty fluky, but I guess I could see that being a problem.
Or maybe they had great relations with everybody else and everybody else votes for them.
Somehow I doubt that would happen, especially because their ability to have any significant presence with the city-states is going to be diminished, considering they don't exist and don't have any gold for a period.
And if all the city-states got wiped out?
Well, then who's voting for them?
Other civs.
Why?
Because they're not you.
That's one of the G&K things. You can't vote for yourself anymore, so they always vote for the one they like the most, or the least, less bad.
I guess. I mean, we're getting to some pretty unlikely scenarios here.
Yeah, but, you know, you have to. It's better than tech trading.
Yes. Yes, I will admit that.
Number 7 from episode 186. Gold rushing not yet started productions possible, but not to those partially so remains questionable.
We have a comment on Reddit from Jedi Time Lord. Okay, that's mixing two science fiction things I don't even want to think about. And he's talking about a Common Sense Civ 5 issue that he's never seen discussed. He says, why can't I start producing something, then hurry up with gold, however much I haven't produced yet? They did this in 3 and 4, and now I don't think it makes any sense for developers to move it, especially considering you can just buy things outright. For example, if an archer costs 200 gold or 40 hammers, I don't know this number offhand, I should be able to work on it for 30 hammers and then buy it immediately for 50 gold. Has anyone else desired this? By the way, I think you asked and answered the question right there.
Yeah.
I mean, thing is that units are cheaper in Civ 5 relative to hammers than they were in the previous two games. That's number one. And also, yeah, I liked it in Master of Orion 2 when I half finished something and I could just pay for the rest in gold. But in this case, it's a gameplay balance issue, I'm pretty sure.
And I wouldn't say that they removed it. They just didn't add it to the Civ 5 code.
The one thing that annoys me, but I now understand, is that you just can't simply transfer hammers to a new project. You know, say you're working on this, and, oh, I want to work on this now. Can't do that anymore. Those hammers go bye-bye.
Yeah. It's been many years since you could do that.
I was just saying you could do it.
Yeah, in Civ 3.
Exactly.
Okay, yes, since Civilization 5 came out, through Brave New World, the developers removed a lot of the gold from the map that you could get very early on. They also made it so that you can't say, hey, would you like this resource for 200 gold? Instantly declare war. Now it has to be, you know, gold per turn. You need to get caravans or cargo ships and be able to protect those routes, construct those units, etc., etc. But if you are able to not just buy anything and everything outright from the start of the game, unlike in Civ 4 when you had to adopt universal suffrage, right?
Yes. And it sucked until you had towns.
If you had it so that gold could also be used as a substitution for partial production as well as production. Okay, can I troll this at the extreme? Venice? Okay, excluding Venice, which is the extreme.
The trolliest gold civ of all.
Because I could see someone saying, well, then you just go and tweak Venice. Like, what's the big deal? To me, this is about making a choice. That, yes, you want players to have choices, but you also want there to be the potential for consequences for choices. Oh, I really should have started producing this a little sooner, but I'll just go ahead and rush it with gold. And I'm talking about a unit here as opposed to a building, because, of course, you know, I can't. I've already built a theater. Let's build a theater again. No. I can't just buy it with gold. Okay, I need to rush production. Can I go on production focus? Even if I result in a little starvation here for a couple of turns, that's okay. I really need this. I need to push this out, or I need to move some other units back, or another city starts to need to produce a unit. To me, it just becomes a too many options in a way that it's too easy to say, oh, well, it doesn't matter as much what I did do or I didn't do. I can cover my ass too easily, and I think that's why it's not in here.
You know what? Listening to you, Dan, I think the next expansion should be Civ 5. A million is a statistic. Just starve your people. Starve your people to build this granary. We don't care.
But you can starve them for a future. You're not going to necessarily lose population right away.
You're still denying them food.
Well, the trade-off is it's like, hey, you starve for a few turns, and then you can actually maybe continue to live, as opposed to a whole bunch of you getting wiped out when the city gets captured, because you didn't have that short-term pain for long-term gain. And yes, I'm talking about gameplay, not realism, before anyone sends me hate mail.
Ben, merciless autocrat, with some pragmatism. Just starve them for a while, they don't care, they're virtual.
Don't try to flatter me, sir.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Long listeners to the show are like, I remember when Dan was a builder before he became such a warmongering bastard.
Yeah, you made me go to Reddit. People are calling me on Reddit. I'm like, stuff's happening. We're arguing. Go get mad.
The reason nobody else is really saying anything on this topic is because they don't want to actually say out loud that they agree with me.
Oh, I agree with you. I just...
Thank you.
I'm just pissed off I said it before either. That's all.
And it is possible for your opinions to be correct, and that's when they are the same as my own opinions.
And that's when the universe seems a little less stable.
Well, I wasn't very stable to begin with, so I don't really think that's much of a concern.
Oh, you belong at a stable. I'm sorry. I don't actually mean that. I just needed to say it. You could. Whoa. You couldn't let me say that without jumping right in there with that, even if it was true or not.
Number 6 from episode 171, when the Civilization developer responds to fan preference for game expansions over downloadable content, it's noticed.
How about sales numbers? They can listen to that and realize, this wasn't such a hot idea.
That is something worth listening to.
That was a topic I posted over on Strategy Informers. The title of the article was, fans didn't just want to buy Civs with DLC, and the Gods and Kings was extremely popular. It's a short article, but the important part is they thought it would be an easier thing just to put out some a la carte civilizations, but everybody's like, no, can you give that to me in a bigger pack or bigger pack, or maybe, you know, especially a bigger pack that has, like, gameplay with it?
Yep. Wasn't there gameplay with each one, though? It was a scenario.
Yeah, but not a real...
Not a mechanic, like religion or...
I understand that. Or...
People always look for tweaks to the core gameplay. I'm actually happy with the community that they really pushed for more full-blown expansions that were then successful. That was a good thing for the game in general.
But we've seen this before with Civ 4. There was two major expansions in Warlords and Beyond the Sword. It's not new. Even the timings of how they've done it isn't typically new either.
No, but there was concern that they wouldn't do it and that they would go to a DLC-only model. That's only really viable if the DLC can add like strong features similar to what we'd see in an expansion, which an expansion's probably a better model for it in terms of development, I think.
I have no issue with them releasing new civs and new scenarios, single-player mods and that kind of thing, because those are fun, and there's challenges with the achievements.
Yeah, there's no problem with that.
I have no problem with that as long as they're accurately priced.
Yeah, and that's what some other people have complained about as well, at least on the forum, is that the price, if you bought every single DLC up to the point of Gods and Kings, that it was more expensive and you got less civs and less stuff in comparison to the price of Gods and Kings.
Well, all these things are relative. I mean, I bought everything separately. I bought Gods and Kings separately. I think I must have spent in dollars, best part of $100. And then the gold version comes out, and for like a day, you can buy it for $5 or $10 or something. So, you know, hey, that's how it works. That's life, you know. That's
that's always life. So if you wait to a point where no one's playing a game, you can get it really cheap. It doesn't mean that
no one's playing the game.
Yeah, because, I mean, when you purchase downloadable content or, say, you purchase an expansion pack on the very first day, it's probably a better example with an expansion pack. I'll probably get less hate mail if I focus on an expansion pack rather than the DLC, because I don't think this argument extends so easily to DLC. To me, you're not just paying the price in order to get that experience period. You're getting that time. So the time in between when the expansion pack comes out and then it's heavily discounted, yes, you've got it for a considerable discount. You didn't pay as much money, but you didn't also have that time in between when the expansion came out and the time that you purchased it in order to play. So you're paying for the time. You're paying for more time in order to play that particular expansion pack or that additional content before somebody else, either completely or until they wait until it becomes heavily discounted. And we know that Steam loves their heavily discounted sales.
But the strategy there, Dan, is to not buy it when it's really expensive and you watch Majin videos on YouTube so you become an expert and then buy it in the sale. Boom. Beat everybody with all his training. And it's cheaper.
It's cheaper.
There's a fine balance between that, though.
But you didn't get to play it.
You didn't get to play it.
you can take advantage of gameplay situations that may then be patched in the future, whereas if you wait, then you are not going to get that pre-patch experience, which either might be more exploitative. Some people might like to use that word.
You're doing so well before this, Dan. You were giving a sound economic argument, but
right up
come on,
that
man.
Much.
Really?
You missed out on the X. It's not just an economic argument, though, Steve.
You've gotten away from the economic argument here now.
Yeah. That's because my economic argument stands on its own. I don't need to defend it anymore. Now I'm adding more to my argument.
Dan is only further proving the theory that the best face is a troll face. Take advantage of those exploits while they're still around, listeners.
But I put exploit in quotations. Some people might actually like the way it was before it was patched. It might not have been an exploit.
Yeah, that's all. Definitely not an exploit that got patched. Nope.
Declare war, make peace.
No, one of the things, and actually I bring back the forums because they had a very similar discussion on the forums related to this, is that they don't mind buying DLC civs and DLC scenarios, stuff like that, but they prefer if the order of operation was build core game, expansion, then DLC.
Hmm.
That people would be willing to buy DLC civs after the game is fully fleshed out with all the different expansions. Because at that point, if the mechanics are solid, then any new DLC is going to be able to take, for a DLC civ, is going to take advantage of some part of all of the mechanics rather than a DLC civ like, say, Polynesia or Spain or the Incans or whatever that don't get to take advantage of all of the brand new mechanics that showed up after vanilla.
I think that's a good point, too. And from a longevity of the game standpoint, I don't think that it could hurt it, and it might even help it. Because people are more willing to be patient early on with the expansions in the works, and then once the game's nearing the end of its life cycle, you can keep it going if you have solid DLC.
Yep. I prefer they just patch the game in between releasing the expansions instead of releasing DLC. Patch it so that you fix the issues, you fix the little bugs. Mm-hmm. Focus on that rather than making money, and you'll make, you know, more money when you release the DLC. I mean, look, I don't know what their business model is, but Civ 5 is an awesome game, but it has issues. And, I think when they released the next version of it, we got bad reviews when it came out, so vanilla, okay? So that turned a lot of people away from thinking about it, and it wasn't an accessible game for new people into strategy games, certainly turn-based strategy. So when you look at the expansion, how much better is that in terms of attracting new gamers to the game? And do the patches in between vanilla and, say, Gods and Kings and the next one improve it in that way? And I don't think they have. I think the patches they've done haven't been very good, in my opinion. And I'd rather they focused on that and then maybe get more people playing the game.
They put out more patches than they put out DLC before Gods and Kings came out.
Then the question is whether or not they've addressed the proper things in the patches or whether it was kind of one step forward and two step back. That's another consideration. But that continual success of patches in the midst of DLC being released and then Gods and Kings being released and then more patches being released, while certainly Brave New World development was also ongoing as well, it's just a further reflection of that, yes, they are paying attention to what the community is having to say. And it's not just, okay, well, here it is. We're done. Goodbye. It's been 12 months. It's been 18 months since the game has been released. Like it or don't, go to the Monty community. Don't talk to us. There has been that interaction and there has been that response. Certainly there are kind of those, I can't believe they put that in this patch that's been an issue like for the last few months as opposed to something that's been an issue since vanilla. And we could certainly think of particular. That's getting more into the nitty-gritty details, but certainly it hasn't just been, let's just do DLC, let's do expansion packs, let's not focus on fixing what is already out there. And I also remember part of the arguments that some people were saying in the community was, and I'm not saying this is the best way to approach it, but I think they were probably looking at, let's see if people are willing to pay for downloadable content, and if there's a strong enough interest in that downloadable content, which are just kind of little things, so we can be working on patching and we can be working on this new downloadable content, then if there is that money and there's that continued interest in terms of the response we're getting for the patches, people purchasing the downloadable content, then that can then fuel kind of an upfront cost for a particular expansion pack, and then see, okay, now that that expansion pack is out there and the downloadable content has already been out there, how have sales of the expansion pack compared with downloadable content, you know, in the short term as well as the long term, and then make a decision on what they're going to do after
that. The DLC model would have worked if they'd got an 8 or 9 out of 10 game from the start instead of a 6 out of 10 game.
Well, there were some people that rated it 8 or 9 out of 10, actually, at the outset.
Yeah, let's not go there.
You know what I mean? Like, if they got a game that was more broadly appealing to...
I would care less about broadly appealing. Let's just say, well, if they built a game that was solid and worked...
It didn't fall over multi... It had a client-server technology or something like that rather than this peer-to-peer stuff we've been dealing with for 10-plus years.
Yeah, just make sure that maybe they had a game that worked.
Yes, that would have been nice.
As the basis.
Indeed, indeed. It's a little like the... I don't know if you guys have followed SimCity recently. It's a terrible...
I've heard stuff about it.
I don't want to go on about it.
No, it is not to be mentioned on this show.
But it got terrible reviews because...
I remember in SimCity 2000, man, those were the days.
The original SimCity was great.
True.
Period.
Good enough. We have adequately addressed SimCity on our SIP podcast.
Dennis actually mentioned in the interview with regards to fans didn't just want to buy DLCs. You know how Beyond the Sword felt when it came out? It felt like this complete experience being Brave New World. So we'll just have to see what fan thinks of it when it comes out. But we'd like to think this is going to be one of those things that just wraps it up as a complete experience. But of course, there's an asterisk beside that because we already know that there is to be a full patch. So it doesn't mean that Brave New World is kind of the be-all and end-all of everything. But I think might be getting at in terms of what happens after Brave New World comes out and after the fall patch, or maybe even in between Brave New World and the fall patch and then after the fall patch, what will Civ 5 hold? Will that be Civ 5 complete, like it ended up being with Civilization 4 with Beyond the Sword, with the exception of a couple of patches afterwards? Time will tell.
Number 10 from episode 178.
All right, I think we're actually about to begin. Oh, there's Mackie.
Hi, Mackie.
It's time for us to all settle down.
Nope. Everybody needs to settle down.
Number 9 from episode 184.
My favorite one to look at was it counts the number of times you have constructed certain wonders in the game. And for me, I've constructed Notre Dame 23 times, the Oracle 25 times, and the Hagia Sophia 24.
There you go. And what's your bullied gold stat?
Yeah.
It is 123,007.
Jesus, what are you doing?
You bully them every single time.
It's a bully.
Why do you do this?
Why wouldn't you do this?
You're shooting at 123,000
gold.
The negative consequences are pretty freak minimal because your influence is going to restore. They're going to silly forget after a little while.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, see, I've only got 2,055.
Probably have like 200.
Number 8 from episode 186.
He wants a particular focus on balance rather than fun, because apparently his idea of fun is just giving Shaka lots and lots of nukes.
That would be fun. He's right.
It's like giving Phil lots of nukes. You know what the result's going to be.
Well, he mentions me directly in this comment, so... I mean, whatever.
Oh, okay, that's what TMIT is. All right, there we
yes.
go.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how they spell Phil on the internet.
This specific Phil is spelled TMIT.
Number 7. From episode 165.
This is why someone else needs to introduce this topic, because it'd just be a mass editorialization.
Yeah, so other than Dan's sheer and utter hatred for this thing, and his sheer refusal, even though he completely and utterly hates this thing, to build it himself first.
That is not an appropriate response.
It is!
Yes, it is!
It is the most appropriate response to deal.
Denied!
The only thing to stop them from building it is to build it yourself!
Exactly!
It shouldn't be that, okay, let me say what it is that I'm trying to say. It shouldn't be that, okay, Dan, well, given the nature of this, I guess you'd better build it yourself before somebody else. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying that shouldn't just be the automatic response, and therefore it's not an issue, that we shouldn't address the issue otherwise. That's what gets me annoyed.
So, and it's just the fact that it always happens to Dan exactly when he goes to attack a Civ, and whatever Civ he chooses to attack is the one who happens to build the Great Wall a couple turns later. I think that's part of Dan's hatred. Dan declares war. Great Wall goes up. What?
Number 6 from episode 180.
but the can only be used once per city means don't even think about a rinse repeat. I'll take the city.
I'd like to take it back.
I'll take the city, and I will catch up. No, no, no. You will not be able to muster your forces and relish in that opportunity. It only happened once.
Oh, the pun, the pain.
Stealth. 3-4-1. It was like a triple play.
Number 5, from episode 185, Comparing and Contrasting Views on Turn-Based Strategy Development by two companies in the field, including Civs.
Thomas Johansson, who's a project lead at Paradox, and talked to you, Ed Beach and Dennis Sherrick from Everett Firaxis, who we've had on before, to talk about their different approaches to games. So they have the examples of Civ and Europa Universalis here, which are, you know, they're both strategy, but they're really, really different.
This is an interesting article because two very well-known companies for strategy games, and all strategy games are not created equal. Strategy is already a segment, you know, of the gaming population, and then Paradox focuses, I think, even more on kind of like a more of a niche within strategy games where you get into a lot of the micromanagement and technical stuff. But still, there are places where they agree and where they disagree, and that's what the article sets up. You try to compare like things as possible, and sometimes you get different answers. And I think part of that stems from what their particular audience is. What is it they're making a strategy game for? Who is their target market? Like, for example, strategy versus other genres. Paradox says, well, the focus of development tends to be more focused on making a working game world. Whereas you go over to Firaxis, and they say, well, no, it heavily relies on underplaying a gameplay system and mechanics to convey the fun of the game.
Yeah, screw your world. We'll do that last. We'll make the game fun first. Then we'll throw some stuff on the map.
Wait, that's a revolutionary idea. The game's fun first?
What? Well, you also have to keep in mind, I mean, we have to frame this so that people who usually just play Civ don't get this weird idea about Paradox. The two types of games that are being discussed here, Civ versus, say, EU or CK2 or, you know, all of that stuff, they're actually two completely different games. Paradox does the grand strategy, more historical simulation style of strategy.
Yeah, I would go simulation. Yeah.
Where Firaxis does the, we pull from history, but that's just names and places and stuff like that. Everything else after that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's more of an abstraction.
Yeah.
Yeah, Paradox seemed to be more focused heavily on you recreating history or only changing it slightly, while Firaxis is like way alternate history.
Reimagining.
Well, you can do alternate history.
From you trying to play the Cherokee.
They try really, really hard to make you suck.
Yeah.
The approaches are different. All of the games from Paradox tend to be mimicking history, and it does allow you to go beyond it, but it's more like, you know, it's an Earth map, or it's a map of Europe, or it's blah, 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 and, you know, all the pieces are in there. And there's very detail-oriented in all of those, whereas Civ is more, basis is real life, but we've thrown that out because, you know, you're playing the Americans in 4000 BC. So, build your own universe.
There's no one answer to how you make a strategy game, just like there's no one answer to how do you make eggs.
Exactly. So, while they are very similar in using the word strategy, they're not necessarily the same approaches. For Paradox, making their world does make sense considering that they're trying to mimic the world first.
Yeah, that attention to detail where things are placed precisely, oriented just so at this particular point in time and relative to everything else.
Yeah, events that happened in real life pop up in game, so lots of historical digging and everything else.
Yeah, you get a little bit of that in some Civ scenarios, but not to the same depth that you would in a game where that's, you know, the whole point.
Yeah.
EU, of course, being Europa Universalis, and CK2 being Crusader Kings 2.
Yeah.
And guess what? There was actually a Crusader Kings 1 and 3 earlier Europa Universalises. Imagine that, right? Weird. But they didn't just start off like calling their first title 4. I don't know, you know.
I thought they did. It's the first one I played.
Blending systems together. Guess what? They also happen to disagree, Paradox and Firaxis, but this is not necessarily a bad thing. This is Firaxis. We like to start with a very simple approach for each new system, then add elements that tie in systems together as each mechanic matures. And Paradox is like, well, since our games are sandbox, it's up to you as a player to set your own goals and choose your own destiny, so systems that are fun give a real, reasonably historical outcome and then have the complexity that, you know, matches what it is that we're trying to do. So you might be thinking, do they agree on absolutely anything? Ugh, other than participating in this article? Yes. Playtesting systems. This is actually the one that I found the most interesting because it's kind of moving from disagreeing to more agreeing. You know, like Firaxis talks about, like the internal team is always playing the game from the earliest prototypes of the game, dot, dot, dot. Whereas Paradox is like, it's something I see us doing a lot more of in the future.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Get around to testing our game later. Although, I'm going to point out that there was a sneaky compliment for Frankenstein in there from Firaxis.
Ah, yes, about the dedicated team of external testers. Well, I wasn't going to mention that because, you know, that's...
He didn't want to toot his own horn, but toot-toot!
Oh my gosh, Mac and I used the exact same expression too, almost at exactly the same time. I knew we were on the same wavelength. Yay. Removing fun yet complex. They agree. Like, Paradox is like, if things that are too complicated are, in general, not fun. Yeah, like this thing called real life. And then Firaxis is, in general, if something's too complex, it becomes unfun pretty quickly. I'm not really certain unfun is a word, but okay, I kind of get what you're saying. Wishing to restore things. The idea being, you know, is there something that you removed just because it just didn't work? Firaxis is like, well, we remove very little. And Paradox is like, I can't recall any instance where it happened that a feature was removed for usability reasons that I wish we added. So in other words, if we felt that it would work and it was fun, we put it in. If it didn't meet these conditions, then it didn't. Simpler said than done, let alone people maybe agreeing that certain systems are fun or not. But it is their game. Yes, they're going to take feedback into account, but if they're making a game, then they're going to be making the decisions ultimately what to include and not to include. I know you modders are going to disagree with me, but you know what I'm talking about. Modding is a whole separate thing. I also like the patch versus expansion editions. There was a complete... Well, I'm editorializing now. There was a disagreement.
I'm not sure if it was disagreement. Just Firaxis is like, no...
But yeah, they're like, patches are a great way to make adjustments to systems, and expansions are where we put in new systems. And Paradox is like, if you choose not to buy any DLC, you'll still receive all the patches and game updates. Our goal is that regardless of what DLC you decide to get for the game, you should still receive the very best game that we make.
Okay, Phil? Phil?
F you!
Come on, you get it in there.
F you!
You know why? Here's an exact reason from CK2. There's a sort of Islam, whatever, DLC. Basically, you can play CK2 as Western Europe, but if you don't buy the DLC, you cannot play a country that's Sunni or Shia or basically Muslim. Here's the problem with that. If those countries turn around and start converting other countries in your game, and you're not playing Iron Man or whatever, and you're bouncing around trying to change things, you can't play those countries. The game slowly progresses to the point where you have less and less ability to play the game because you're lacking a DLC.
Yeah, it's not very good.
Oh yeah, and the DLCs are not super cheap, and the game was kind of expensive to begin with, so... F you!
I'm not a fan of any DLC that allows players to play against others who don't have it either and have an advantage because of it. I have encountered that in other games.
This rant brought to you by Imagine's Rage and supported by Phil's Tutelage. And then on the seventh point,
please send all hate mail to Dan Q anyway.
Yeah, I've got an inbox it can go in with giant air quotes. Suggestions for developers. In other words, you know, feedback. Firaxis is like, don't be afraid to revise and iterate on your game systems. And probably the most important thing of all, never underestimate the value of feedback. Sid Meier always says, quote unquote, feedback is fact. I've never actually heard him say that, but that's an absolute statement that's absolutely problematic. I've said this before on the show, but okay. According to Firaxis, which means that your players tell you about the game is key to making your game a better experience for them. I think that's important there, for them, because sometimes we've seen suggestions for how to make a better gameplay experience, and we're thinking, well, for you, maybe. Paradox says, never do a feature without first thinking about how to visualize it and why it's fun for the player. The gamers should have the freedom to take their own choices, and they should be able to play the game again and again, where every game is a whole new experience.
So basically, Paradox does the old school style of, let's pretend we're a fan of the game or we're a player of the game. Is this fun? Let's do a thought experiment. Firaxis says, hey guys, is this fun?
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder which approach has been working better.
Yeah, well, it's the old school versus the more interweb generation style-ish. Although, Firaxis has been doing it long before that, whatever.
And it's an interesting transition to, you know, having people playtesting your game before release from the community. I'm like, wait, didn't you just kind of say something a little different earlier in the article, both of you? But, okay, I guess there's a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just because you have feedback internally from an external group doesn't mean you have to actually listen to it.
We feel like to say something right here.
Nothing I can get away with saying.
Yeah. That was perfect.
There's listening and not listening, and then there's also acting and not acting.
Yep.
Number 4 from episode 169, proactive and reactive suggestions with respect to a civilization other than your own running away with the game.
There was a topic posted with the question of how bad can a civ run away? And Makaz asks, I mean, every game got one or two civs running away in size, science, or otherwise, but what is the worst you have ever faced as such? In a recent game, I received a notification that Korea had completed the Manhattan Project in 1640 on standard speed. Has anybody else noticed some terrible threatening runaway as such?
I gotta say, the definition of runaway seems to be a little off. If you have a civ building the Manhattan Project in 1640 AD, standard speed, as in turn 220-ish, you're probably a little behind. As in, the A is being slow about it.
Well, what difficulty is he playing on? You know, that's the big question.
Well, apparently Emperor, but even still, turn 220 at Emperor.
Oh, on Emperor, that's not really runaway.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, runaway is where I think somebody else down here posted something. Oh, for vanilla, one continent for an AI, blah, blah, blah. Alex posted a UN countdown at, and then Wynn was at 212. That is a runaway.
Yes.
Yeah, the only time I tend to have problems with a runaway AI that I can't control but doesn't just steamroll me is when it's like a continent-style map, something like that. And
yes.
I have the misfortune of having to deal with my interior neighbors and can't focus on putting a fleet together to go bother the guy.
Yeah, when they're off on another continent left to their own devices because they had very little competition or very poor competition. So in other words, either they were able to steamroll relatively quickly and then expand out, or for some reason they were able to take over a couple of other or more other already developed AI, and then it's there sitting there waiting for you to catch up and do the same on your continent. Yeah, that's what to me lends itself to runaway AI potential, and not just in Civ 5.
Yeah, you run into like Alexander, it's like 1200 or 1300 AD. He has 40% of the world's land, and he's the only thing left alive on this continent. That's that kind of stuff is runaway.
Looking at this, you know, random picture that was attached, somebody entered the atomic era about turn 220. Yeah, well, that's not a runaway. And the fact that number one person in power is the player.
Right.
I'm sorry. That's a solution right there.
Yeah, that's not considered a runaway.
Well, maybe you are at the runaway.
Yeah, like you beat in the runaway. Yeah. Completing Apollo before turn 200, that would probably be a bit of a runaway. Or at least the start of one, considering that if they build the Apollo, they don't necessarily go for the spaceship tax.
Yeah, runaways tend to be centered more on the size of their empire than their speed for most of the game. And then right at the end, because they have so many cities and they finally built some things in them, then they tend to shoot forward right at the end. But for the most part, I don't know if their tech position is the best metric of a runaway as compared to their size and building potential.
Well, it is in the fact that they'll have better weaponry and better buildings and better everything else.
I guess, but they're so stupid. So if you can come up with a comparable force or even sort of match their tech, you can still kill them.
To a point. Frigate fleets are a great equalizer for a long time, but the moment somebody has air power, if they're that far ahead, you might as well just walk away.
That's true. I guess my point is I would rather use that kind of equalizer. You know, there's probably going to be a window for something like that, rather than try and take on somebody who has their entire continent with frigates, because it just slows the game a lot.
Oh, yeah. Don't let the AI run away in the first place. If you see an AI start to crush everybody around them, you might want to do something about that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how bad can a Civ run away? I don't know. How bad do you want it to run away?
True for human players, too, by the way. If you're in a competitive multiplayer game and someone's stomping on his neighbors, it should be worth some attention.
I liked Zizima's post in this thread. There really is no reason to be so competitive about whose runaway is better than whose. My runaway can beat up your runaway.
Yeah, I definitely laughed when I first read that because the thread did start sort of taking that tone.
Nuh-uh, man, my runaway's worse.
Number 3 from episode 170. A playing wanting to win, not deciding who else wins, leads to a letter to the show and a reply.
We have received mail. We got mail. Right. Yay. So this is an email from Travis, and he has a question about enhancing his Civ 5 game. I have recently started playing on Emperor difficulty, and I can pull off scientific victories pretty easily, but I can't take a domination game. I will give a specific example. My most recent game was as Arabia, 8 players, Pangaea, standard speed, default settings. Okay, fairly standard. I started in the Far East, and Hiawatha started in the Far West. Moving from my position to the west, there was Gondi, Mountain Range, Netherlands, then Dido, Hiawatha. Persia was off to the north. Monty and Spain were also hanging out north of Hiawatha. So he set to war almost immediately, only expanding once, and then taking India with comps of bows and horsemen. Okay, so early war, good. In this time, the Netherlands were almost completely wiped out by its neighbors. He got his camel archers and went north to Persia, and he thinks that this diversion cost him the game, but Persia had 10 wonders in his capital.
Yeah.
Really shiny. Yeah.
Hey, you got shinies. I'll take those. That's never a bad diversion.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say.
No, not unless you fail.
Yeah, exactly. After taking the capital, he built and filled universities in all his non-puppeted cities. And then he took a city-state out and one of the Netherlands' last cities, which was on the way to Dido and Hiawatha. So far, it sounds generally okay. He upgraded to artillery and cavalry and took out Dido. Okay, well, there's your problem right there. Upgrading camel archers to cavalry. going from a 3-range, 2-attack per turn unit, once properly promoted, to a melee unit that can't use any of those promotions. I mean, at some point you do have to upgrade, but I generally don't upgrade my camel archers to cavalry, mostly because you're now wasting all those promotions.
Yeah.
And 3-range logistics units, even if they're only doing a couple points of damage, are still doing a couple points of damage versus the cavalry, which won't be able to help that well. Otherwise, he had a 24 pop capital with the National College, as well as full universities, and he's getting public schools in most of his cities at that point. He had about 400 beakers per turn, but Hiawatha was about 14 techs ahead, and the combined efforts of himself and Monty could not stop him from getting to a scientific victory. His Great War bombers would literally just explode on his 150 defense border cities. So this is obviously a very late game.
Yeah.
When he finally upgraded to artillery and cavalry and tried to take on Hiawatha. He suggests that he should not have gone bombers, but Hiawatha didn't seem to have any planes, and Arabia, of course, gets the double oil, so it does sound like a great plan. Last thing he says is that he did only expand once, but annexed any decent city that he took over because he had so much cash as Arabia, he could easily buy courthouses and other buildings.
That might be a problem.
A bit of an issue. Because you don't necessarily need to annex every single city.
Mm-hmm. You use the cash to buy units.
Exactly. That
in a city that has the infrastructure for the experience.
Exactly. So social policy-wise, he did go tradition, honor with legalism, landed elite, and full honor track before taking the center column of order, which leads towards the extra science from factories and reduced cost of buildings, everything else along that line. It's not a bad place. Now, if he said he went autocracy and failed hard, well, that's because he went autocracy. but he did go order, so it was a good plan. So he says, when he goes for domination, he always seems to be kingmaker instead of king. This particular game, he thinks Hiawatha got a little lucky that Monty absorbed Spain before turning his eyes to the city, spamming Iroquois. But this issue does happen every time. And he'd be happy to answer any further questions or even call in on the show. So anyways, what do you guys think about that?
Well, I think we already covered number one. You shouldn't have annexed all those cities.
That is true.
Came a larger thing, too. That probably slowed the war down a bit.
Well, camel archers are really good for trashing everything.
I mean, upgrading them to cavalry, like you mentioned earlier. It sounds to me just like these wars early on took too long relative to his tech rate. Because this can happen in any Civ game if you're conquering, but you're not keeping up in tech. Eventually, you can get to the point where you just can't take someone out because they're too far ahead of you.
Well, for the 150 defense border cities, artillery is a little better than bombers or Great War bombers when it comes to that, because you're not taking damage. Even if you're not doing as much damage as you possibly could, your artillery's not going to get hit.
So you just have to clear out anything that can kill your RD really easily.
And, of course, as always with bombers, pay attention when you're using
them. Don't send a red-lined bomber in on that 150 defense city.
And get to air repair as fast as you possibly can, and set down a unit that has a medic next to it, and therefore the air repair will get medic boosted.
Ooh.
I mean, bombers tend to be the way to go, because, hey, bombers.
One unit per hex? Not anymore.
Nine units in this hex.
Yes. But volume of bombers would probably do better. So as the mean team was already stating, not spending all that money on annexing all the cities and courthouses and actually spending on units probably would have been a better plan.
Especially because those units would have been available to kill Hiawatha sooner, and maybe he would not have had 14 tech lead at that point.
Well, Hiawatha is one of those super spammers.
Yeah.
He can get away with a lot of stuff in the early game, especially if none of his AI neighbors were slowing him down.
Yeah. Even in vanilla, he was probably one of the stronger AIs, if you're talking about like how the computer plays the Civ.
One thing we are missing, though, is turn times from this email. So we don't know, he was pulling in 450 beakers, but is that at like turn 250? Was it at, you know, was Hiawatha getting to like the Snowball Empire, where even the Emperor AI can get to a turn 250 to 300 space race win? Or was this like after turn 300? Was it after turn 400?
Yeah.
So we don't know where approximately that comes in.
Yeah, out of context, beaker values are really difficult to read. As you know, if you're pulling in 450 beakers, you know, in the early ADs, you're doing pretty well, but if you're doing that in, like, the 1900s, not so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're doing mass conquests, you're not...
Oh, yeah, it barely matters. As long as you have enough to kill people, it really doesn't matter. Get some research agreements and some stompage.
You did say he was getting universities and all the tech buildings into his cities, so that's obviously a good thing, because when you're trying to dominate, you still need universities and public schools and all that.
Unless you can get techs by capturing cities.
That's later.
Not sure that they should bother with universities and whatnot. They have their own economy.
Yeah. We'll just take yours. There you go. No, but it does sound like his plan was generally okay. Taking out India with Kalpa, bows, and horsemen. Sure.
Yeah.
That's a good start. Horsemen are great because Gandhi gets his stupid war elephants, so using horsemen to run in and smash them up so that Composables can clean up cities and stuff like that. That's sufficient, because you're also going to see a lot less spear units wandering around with Gandhi. So that's a good choice. Dutch getting wiped out by his neighbors, but he moved into camel archers. That, and yes, as Arabia, if you're going to go fighting, camel archers are absolutely the best unit to do it with in the medieval to industrial era. They're far better than Keshiks once you get the range and logistics going, because they have higher combat strength and higher range damage. They're just slightly slower, but realistically that matters nothing if you're just twitching back and forth shooting at a city. Yeah, without the context of timeline, it sounds like how he was going through was okay, maybe just not fast enough.
Yeah, it might just be a pure micro thing.
Yeah, if he was able to get to camel archers like before turn 100, he would have probably been able to use them for another 100 turns, no problem.
Yeah.
Now, of course, how fast Hiawatha got away with mass spam.
It's not.
Is also
he could have gone for Hiawatha earlier by the sound.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, choosing your targets wisely is probably a very important thing. If you do have a runaway, you probably should go try and stop it sooner than later.
The only time that's really difficult are on continents maps, where you just meet the other continent and it's already one Civ.
Yes, that is a bit harder.
Hopefully they have a coastal capital, because that's a very fun way to win domination.
So it sounds like start position might have been a thing in here.
Number two, from episode 176, the panelist with game AI programming experience talks of intellectual, practical, and tactical balance in its approach.
Although you're just going to run into the thing that it's not like the previous Civ iteration, so some people aren't going to like it for that reason. But in terms of depth from vanilla to what now Brave New World is showing us, it really does have a lot more depth. But for people like me, I'm kind of out of luck. Like, yeah. I don't have a problem with Civ 5 in most of its design. I mean, okay, it's got some flaws, but you know, we all know Civ 4 has plenty of flaws, too. But for me, it's just so slow, and it makes it unplayable after a while because you get an order and you have to wait so much.
Most of it comes down to the pathfinding for the AI. It may not seem like it, but the city-states actually add a lot to the turn time. If you want to reduce your turn time, reduce the number of city-states. I know it doesn't seem intuitive. I've talked to them about this because, you know, I write AI, and there's always a debate in the AI corner. Ooh. Do you put AI logic in your pathfinder? I never do. Now, maybe I should, but Civ 5 does. Every time a unit is doing its pathfinding check, it's going through and looking at all the different things that might happen as it's going down that path.
And there is why, for example, hey, I gave the worker an order to build a plantation or to go over to that tile. Why are you prompting me for orders now? You said you were going to take 3 turns, and then you realize, oh, there's a barbarian in the vicinity.
There's a barbarian 6 freaking hexes away. But, oh, my God, barbarian.
They're probably overcompensating for what they did in Civ 4, where, like, you could set waypoints after producing a unit. Your unit would move out of the city right adjacent to an enemy unit, clearly in view. You'd lose that unit then. There'd be nothing you could do about it.
The irony is that because it's always calling wolf, and you're going, oh, it's nothing, oh, it's nothing, when there actually is a threat, you may overlook it, because you keep dismissing all the times it calls wolf.
Yeah, well, it's not, that's not it in itself. I'm talking about overall. I'm talking about the AI is trying to decide, well, is this a good point? Am I putting myself too much in danger? And so you end up with, in theory, a smarter AI. Now, in like Colossalizations, I cheaped out. What I did is I had another thread. So I had a background smarter. I would occasionally be looking at where the AI was moving. And if it happened to, by luck almost, see that the AI was getting in trouble, then it would actually call it and abort it. The downside is that it's not as smart as the Civ 5 AI is at moving its units.
Oh, good God. Please tell me you did not call the Civ 5 AI smart. Please tell me.
No, he didn't. I'm not talking about the other AI isn't as.
No, the Civ 5 AI, when it's actually in the process of moving, it's better at keeping itself out of danger. My view is that what wins games is not that tactical movement of each and every unit. It's this overall strategy of doing things. Now, I will say, I don't know if you noticed, they did improve the AI massively in some of the last updates. Some of the guys there, I had time to sit down and just play it and play it and play it. People were on Civ Fanatics listening to the strategies, and they did implement a lot of that stuff into some of the more recent Civ 5 patches. So you should notice a pretty significant improvement. Post Gods and Kings.
So should those changes be in effect now?
I only know when they were checked in. I don't know if they've been released. When people say AI, they use the word very broadly when there's really lots and lots of AI going on, right? You have the AI in terms of picking a good place to go, but then you have the AI out, should I even be trying to go there in the first place? And Soren wrote that AI, and that's one of the big differences. Actually, I just talked to Soren a couple weeks ago about this, and this is a big mistake I made in the Elemental game, Fallen Enchantress in particular. In Civ 4, Soren, just not only the designer, but he wrote the AI and he wrote what are called the worker functions. And those are the functions AI queries and asks questions of, is this a good place to go? Or what is the best thing I should wear? Or what is the best unit I should build? And I went, oh, these are pretty easy functions. I would just have one of the guys write them. And then it turned out there was a lot of disconnect. And you end up with some really bad AI. You're calling a function that's returning bad data. And I think in Civ 4, the AI is actually pretty good because Soren did both the AI and the worker functions.
Now, how come he didn't have human automated workers function like AI automated workers when it comes to detecting trouble? That really frustrates me. Your workers will suicide at war, but the AI workers never do this. You never see an AI worker just sitting on a border making a tile improvement and letting your unit snipe them.
Yeah, that's a different issue entirely, because that's one's so. AI, right? AI player, strategic layer, and the other one's more like a unit AI level thing.
Yeah, it's like an intellectual AI versus a procedural AI. like Brad was getting at, how do I move over here because I've been ordered to move over here versus should I move over there at all? Which for the human player, we want the AI to respond to our command. We want to be able to input the command in a reasonable fashion, and then we want the AI to implement that. Like if we say we want you to go to this tile, it's going to show you if it's going to take multiple turns. This is the path that we think that it should take. You could decide to change that. No, rather than automating those three or four turns, I want you to go here. I will then choose the next two or three turns afterwards, as opposed to the AI, which itself would then have to decide, am I going to move that unit over here in the first place? And the AI's ability to first decide, is it important for me now, if ever, to in fact move this particular unit over here versus then, okay, what's the best way for it to get over here?
That's what I'm talking about, though, the latter part. And that should be the same between AI workers and human automated workers. In other words, if you just click on a worker and hit the A button for automate, and they just build improvements on their own forever until you interrupt them, it should perform pretty similarly in terms of the quote-unquote, should I move on to this tile, as an AI worker would.
Even RTS is someone sitting there killing your peons while they're picking berries or whatever, and you go, why won't they move? They're just, the guy next to me just got slaughtered. And then you get into discussions of what should be in the unit AI versus what should be in a strategic AI. And in Civ 4, the decision was made that moving your workers out of peril should be a strategic AI choice. And
how about not moving your workers into peril against your will before you can interrupt it?
Again, I know exactly what you're saying. I'm just saying why it happened.
Yeah.
With the benefit of 5-6 years of hindsight, we can now say it shouldn't have been done that way.
But just because along with automating your workers, though. If you automate your workers, that's what you get. Why you shouldn't automate your workers.
I agree, but at the same time, you're putting in a feature in the game that ultimately isn't usable. So why provide automated workers at all if they're so non-functional that they suicide?
I don't think the AI workers
I think
they're
two different AIs. Blip did the BTS AI, I know, and I think that is the AI that the workers use, whereas the workers in vanilla, the human workers use a bit of the old AI. I mean, I'm guessing.
It's a different function entirely.
I don't think the AI players' workers are on any automated thing. I think the AI is manually, from its perspective, moving its workers, because it doesn't
make sense, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I definitely think Soren did a job of writing the AI. He worked a lot with the MP team at the time and determining, you know, how would we do it and tried to implement that as best you could without acquiring Big Blue to run Civ. Yeah.
That's the thing I like about Civ 4 as a whole. Its design was designed as around being a multiplayer game. Civ 5 didn't do that, and I think it suffered a little bit because of it.
I think it did, too. I think if you designed it in parallel, SP and MP at the same time, like basically Soren did that both sides benefit. And I think Civ 5 was strictly an SP game with MP tacked on at the end, and not very well, to be brutally honest.
There are some reasons for that most people aren't aware of. And in Civ 5, they didn't have any programmers on it for the longest time during development. A lot of them were on XCOM and a whole bunch of other stuff that was going on. And so it was, from a programmatic, number of engineering hours over on Civ 5 was nothing compared to what Civ 4 had going for it.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure the decision to go from GameSpy to Steam happened at the most inopportune time and affected the development as well, too.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, like, remember right before Civ 5 shipped, they laid off a bunch of people at Firaxis?
Yes, I remember.
Well, they laid off networking people, and
yeah, well done,
and so they
guys.
Had to call people off from XCOM to work on the networking because that stuff wasn't done.
Yeah, but they made the brave statement to the public that none of the layoffs would affect development either. I remember that, too.
I'm not very impressed with some of the project management decisions made throughout that project.
Well, remember that a lot of that stuff was happening at the Traxxas. Those were all Take-Two calls.
Oh, no doubt at all.
As an aside to interject, there might be some people listening to this and are wondering, Brad mentioned about programming AI. And Brad, why do you talk about programming AI, and what do you know about space-based civilization-type games?
I'm the designer of Galactic Civilizations, and I programmed AI on that. And then most recently, I wrote the AI for Fallen Chantress and in Legendary Heroes.
I'm really fascinated with AI. I tried programming a handful of times, but I just don't have the mind for it.
We had a game designer fest at my house a couple of weeks ago. Some kind of stuff we talked about.
How much is it really a trade-off between the way you set it up for the near instant turn times and the longer turn times when AI is trying to use better strategy for each of its unit movements?
I personally prefer my way. I don't allow AI to be put into pathfinding because I want to have control over that. what the user will see is that my AI will be much more prone to someone being able to put something in between. Like if I'm trying to go from point A to point B, a player could potentially put something in between those two points and be able to whack the player as he gets through.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it prevents me from being able to do is Civ 5 is, you know how you have territory and the AI isn't allowed to enter it without a treaty?
Yeah.
It's basically impossible for me to write AI that keeps AI from coming into your territory. You know, we have to kick you out of the territory thing, which some people don't like, which for a good reason, because it can be annoying. But the only way, otherwise AI would constantly get bottlenecked and not be able to get anywhere, because you wouldn't be able to get to point B without checking every single tile in between to make sure that there isn't a own piece of territory in between.
Hmm.
If they don't have a non-aggression pact with you, the AI will never walk into your territory, no matter what. And I can't do that in the way my AI is written, because I can't check the tiles in between that are on the way to point B.
I see.
To that degree.
Now, does it have like an auto-interrupt if an enemy does get into the path, makes a new choice?
Not during the pathfinding part of it, when it's actually walking.
I see.
Part. It'll look around and say, oh, well, there's a monster here. I will go and do something else.
But it wouldn't be able to tell there was a monster there normally anyway, right, because of the fog of war.
Well, I mean, even if he could see.
Oh, okay.
Huh. I think it's made worse in Civ 5 because we have the one unit per tile mechanism, so you're pathfinding a lot of units each turn. You can say bad things about Civ 4 stack combat.
The AI looks like it's moving the units individually even in stacks, which is kind of frustrating. But
well, when John came to Stardock, I talked about that. And I said, you know, if you had come up with that at Stardock, we would have vetoed that. Because I always said, you have to come up with a way to come up with the pathfinding when you have that one type, you know, unit per tile thing. Because that's going to be a monster to fix. We just wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
Just even from a human gameplay standpoint, it's a pain in the neck. It's just like you're trying to get negotiate a city-state, and you've got a little, what do you call it, a little peninsula or something, and there's units blocking you, moving your great prophet from spreading the religion. It's like, I'm not trying to do anything. Ugh. I mean, never mind for AIs trying to do the same. Jeez.
Yeah, it just makes the whole thing a lot tougher to do.
I still think just aren't enough hexes. Like, yes. There's too little space between cities, and units take up too much space, essentially.
Yeah, they figured out that 6 tiles is basically the maximum you want cities to tend to be away from each other before it affects the pacing.
I mean, I wouldn't have minded scaling the game such that you have way more hexes and then giving units more movement. You just have more mobility then.
That's true.
But keeping your production scale the same. Because then a lot of these logjam issues are less serious. I mean, it's not like they wouldn't happen, but they'd happen much less frequently.
Yeah, well, that was essentially our solution. Every unit gets 2 moves.
Oh, yeah, and that did happen in Civ 5 as well. But I think you could even go further with it. If you're really looking for a 1 unit per hex model, especially with zone of control also a factor.
The pathfinding would be even nastier.
Civ 5 has zone of control.
The longer your pathfinding tree is, it gets exponentially more expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had this conversation with other MP players, and basically every successful 1 unit per tile game have all been tactical level games, you know, like Panzer General. Problems you deal with in a tactical level game are quite different than a strategic level game that's Civ. And I don't think we ever got the 1 unit per tile system right in a strategic level game.
The people who argue for 1 unit per tile and saying stack combat was too easy and too boring, that was primarily because the AI couldn't play the game in war and Civ 4. It's like, you do that to another human, you will get absolutely massacred, as Phil would gladly tell you.
Oh my gosh, there was a guy in our turn cast, this is like well over a year ago now, I think it's closer to 2 years ago. He basically got destroyed by an AI, so it rejoined in as the AI, and refused to give me a city that I'd really been targeting all game. So I decided I was just going to culture flip it. But he didn't like this, of course, because I was taunting him a little bit. And I admit I was trying to bait him into attacking me, and he certainly did. So this guy declares on me. Yeah, maybe I'm like 75% of his power, or maybe not quite. And because he moved his stack into my territory like that, he was dead by like 10, 15 turns. I'd taken every single one of his cities, even though he's significantly stronger than me. You don't want to screw around with that. But that's how the AI moves into your borders, too. And if, you know, the only reason it's even challenging at all in Civ 4 is the bonuses. Because otherwise you could just stack wipe it like nothing and it wouldn't be able to reproduce anything in time. You just kill all of
the
cities.
And the thing that gets me the most, the AI in Civ 5 is much worse.
I don't know. I don't know that you can say that with certainty.
I can.
Because the tactical demands in Civ 5 are a little bit higher.
To do the AI in Civ 5 is a lot tougher than Civ 4.
Civ 4 had some tactical elements that 5 lacks and vice versa. I would say Civ 5 has a little bit more demand there than 4, but not as much as people claim.
No.
Number 5 from episode 179.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to phone Mackie, and then she's going to see the number, and then she'll magically appear.
Mm. Okay.
Oh, wait, no, she magically appeared right now.
Threatened to do it.
Awesome. You're about to get a phone call.
Number 4 from episode 165.
Fury Crab says, the line between you exploiting the AI tactics and you just holding your ground to a dumb enemy unit is a bit of a blur. However, it's mostly about setup and intention. No one can stop you from doing it, but I personally never find it fun to win by pulling off AI exploits.
Yeah, kind of like selling all your stuff to the AI before you die.
He also mentions that in his post, as a matter of fact, Dan.
That doesn't happen in our games at all.
That is not an exploit. Yeah, that's just a painfully obvious tactic.
Yeah, it is a painfully obvious tactic. Working as intended.
Damn.
Number 3 from episode 185.
Makalua.
Oh, hi.
What's up, lady? You're late. I just stole your coffee.
I got it right here. Ha.
No.
Don't make me turn this podcast around.
Too late for that.
Turn the podcast around. No. Okay.
Your bets would love to feel percussion on your head.
Ooh, Mackie's going to play some.
Mackie's going to touch me. Okay.
Come on. Really? Really?
Number 2 from episode 164.
Just like in anything, I mean, anything that's worthwhile doing is not going to be easy. But it's worth it because, you know, we're worth it. And so are you two, audience. Aww, group hug.
I knew he was going to say group hug.
Mac knows me well. You know, Mackie and I have been together for 7 years.
Hey. What's up?
On the show.
Thank you.
Right.
I didn't say that way on purpose, Mackie.
Mackie's pretty emphatic about how you phrase that thing. I still think we should permanently ally Mackie.
If they weren't being entertained, they wouldn't be coming back, so.
True.
True story.
Number 1 from episode 168 on having unique research paths in Civ's technology tree is perennial.
Endrimner has come up with an idea, a new sort of tech tree for future games, a suggestion to introduce unique tech trees. Not necessarily fully unique, the tech tree would be the tech tree, but the too long didn't read summary is basically to use high-level tech tree to, like, sort of like what we have right now, where you go through different techs and you have to go through, you know, the high-level side. And then you would specialize within techs if you so choose, so that, say, you get bronze working, that's just a high-level tech, and you might get some sort of bonus just for researching it. But to build a spearman, you would have to spend more research to actually research the spearman. Or on the other side, if you want culture or whatever, you can spend the time to build the Colossus. So basically, the concept he's going for is that every tech has some peaceful applications and some military applications and other applications, whatever. So it just basically wants to not let everybody just hit a tech and get absolutely everything in that tech, but actually take some time to focus. So if you don't really want to do early wars, then you can burn your way through some of the early techs, but then focus, say, on the culture buildings and everything else. And it also would prevent silly things like the AI just building every single world wonder just because they happen to have gotten the tech, not because they actually need it or want it, and other such things. It's a really long post, and I think that's about the sum of it. I like the idea. It's actually it's very similar to what I've suggested before, or at least have been thinking about before as well. I like the idea of basically not having to get everything when you hit a tech, but being able to basically specialize into little things. It's very similar to what he's going for here. And it would work fairly well. It is somewhat similar to some other game styles where you hit something big and then you have to dig into them.
to get
this. Yeah, but I think this mechanic could actually add to any of the Civ titles, at least that I've played in recent memory.
Yeah.
Including 5, but not limited to.
So, yeah, I would actually definitely agree with the concept. I mean, Civ 5's tech tree is pretty crap, at least in the design. Civ 4 had the better tech tree because you could at least jump from one side of the tech tree to another with requirements. But at least with this, you could slide out different directions as you need. I like it.
There's also a focus on the now part aspect, where you can use like aspects of your current technologies by digging deeper into them to get something, or you can try to reach, but you'll temporarily be weaker as a result of it, and I like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's always balance. If you skip the military tech, but somebody comes along and grabs, say, spearmen, and you decide to jump to swordsmen, well, you better hope that you have the time to get into swordsmen before the spearmen show up.
Yes.
Or if you're going some other way. So, yeah, all the special stuff and all the wonders and everything else come from not just hitting the tech, but actually researching them within the tech.
I really like it. Yeah, I like the strategy aspect that would add to the game and the diversity.
Yeah, and it would provide some uniqueness. And it would prevent certain situations like architecture in Civ 5 where it's just like a couple wonders. So
yeah, what's the point of researching that? It's only because I have to have other things past architecture that I ever research that.
And so if those wonders are already gone, you don't waste your time. And that would actually work in this system as well. Since you have to research for the particular wonder or, say, the particular building, if you don't have it, well, then you just skip it for the forge. So if you don't have the iron sitting around, then you don't bother researching a forge. And you just keep going, since forges boost iron tiles and all that.
I like the suggestion as well towards what's already been said, but just even in more general, the ability to adapt to your particular circumstances, just another measure as a human player, again, to be able to adapt. So if you think you're going down one particular path, let's go culture. Okay, I want to focus on culture. Oh, but now I've got to backtrack and get this military technology so I can continue down the culture path. Really, you're going to bottleneck me? Oh, my gosh. Just to try to avoid that. And then, yes, I am going to raise this requisite point because it's just naturally that it comes up, especially in a single player. The artificial intelligence, of course, would need to be able to use this. I'm not going to say extremely well or very well. That might be a bit of a high threshold. I'll just go with competently. I think that can be a function. In fact, that might be the biggest obstacle.
Actually, it's easy to get them to do it. Because all you have to do is, like, so say you have the node like he's got in the picture where, say, Bronze Working has 4 different nodes to it. You just sum the value of those nodes and just do a node edge graph for it. And so if it's going cultural, when it hits the tech, which will have the sum of all the nodes to it, it'll then look at does it keep going forward? So does the waiting edge weight want it to lead forward, or does it need that wonder? And therefore, the waiting on the nodes within the tech would let you do it. So there is ways to do it fairly effectively. Just because Civ and the developers don't necessarily know how to do that very effectively doesn't mean it can't be done.
Well, you're saying the AI is competent anyway, but it really...
Oh,
it isn't. Without its bonuses, it's a joke. So, I mean, that's really not a barrier in any mechanical sense for a Civ game. The AI is terrible, and we all know it, so...
Well, it's not bad at some things. Digging through a tree is not hard for the AI, or to build as an AI. All you have to do is dig through a tree. Can even extend it and use different concepts, like you don't have to go from one high-level tech to another high-level tech always. Sometimes maybe there's alternate paths or other such things, depending on what you've done. Or even maybe some of these sub-paths lead into techs, so that maybe you have to go through the cultural side, say, in this Bronze Working to Sculptures to Wonders, as he wrote out here, and that leads to a different culture tech or some other tech rather than the main path. That could be a more interesting way of being able to wander through the tech tree.
And number one from episode 169.
Other issues. Of course, people are still mad that multiplayer doesn't work. A bunch of other stuff still hasn't been fixed. I mean, this is just a tiny patch, and people were kind of a little mad that... didn't change a bunch of stuff.
You'd almost think they were busy working on something else right now.
Yeah, you think.
Yeah, I wonder what that could be.
Me too.
Oh, wait, I was segueing into something.
Yes,
okay.
You were. And I was helping you segue. And then you threw it off.
And then you talked about doing a segue, and then it just the wheels just kind of fell off. But
yeah,
that's what we do on this show. You're consistent.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659. That's 441-228-8-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for tuning in to Polycast Evergreen Season 7. I'm about to Locutus Snyders. You must comply.
Civilization 1 Clips, copyright MicroProse.
Civilization 4 Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.